and welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. and Monday mornings at 1 a.m. are when you can hear the broadcast on the radio and streamed live at richarddugan.com. But they are also posted as podcasts on richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. There's a player on the homepage of richarddugan.com, as well as going over to SoundCloud and typing in Tell Me Your Story or Richard Dugan. Also on iTunes, and we're going to be expanding that a little bit more as we move forward. Those are the main places where you can find the radio broadcast, and we are certainly hoping that you will do that. Please investigate, research, or we will be linked to our guest's website as well. 10 out of 10. The link that you're looking for is the name of the guest. So if you click on the guest's name, boom, you are taken to their website. And we're very grateful for our guests. And sometimes these interviews go longer than the radio broadcast duration of 50 minutes. That's 50 minutes. All depends upon our guests' availability, if they're able to stay with us longer than that. And we are going to basically draw all kinds of information out of them that we can so that you can be better informed as to, what they're talking about. And hopefully continue your individual evolutionary process. I know that's what I'm in the process of doing, and some days are easier than others. Share with you that later on, but right now we're going to be talking about dispelling the myth that the brain produces consciousness and the implications for everyday life. Mark Gober's my guest. He's the author of a new release called An End to Upside Down Thinking. Interesting title. We're going to find out what that means from Mark. Mark, thank you for joining us on the program via Skype.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, when I first saw the title, this movie came to mind. The movie is called Upside Down. And it's a science fiction film about two planets that are so close together that the two civilizations that live on the each of these planets have built basically buildings that connect to one another. That's how close these planets are. And each of them maintains its individual gravity. So you have to come in contact with this ore that is mined on one of the two planets that allows you to go to the other planet and reverse the gravity so that you don't fall. But this is what came to mind when I thought of this, because you're talking about two different kinds of thinking. As if you're referring to an end to upside down thinking, we're going to certainly get the definition of that. I know it has to do with this concept that consciousness creates all material reality, and biological processes do not create consciousness. Now, this has been sort of the eternal question as to certainly the difference between our soul or spirit and our consciousness. Some people believe they're one and the same. Some people think that they're two different things. And certainly we're trying to figure out where it resides. Some would say, it resides in the heart. You know, it's the muscle. That's its own. And some people say it's the brain. It's like these kinds of eternal questions that the great ancient wisdom teachings certainly talk about. But you're talking about this from somewhat of a similar perspective. First of all, what's the opposite? What's the opposite of upside down thinking? Right side up thinking?
I guess so. Okay. Yeah. So maybe we can start with the definition of what I mean by upside down thinking.
Please.
That works. Okay.
Go for it.
So what I'm describing as upside down thinking is actually the worldview that I used to have before I got into this research about 2 years ago. My background is not in the consciousness space. I actually work in business. I'm a partner at a firm in Silicon Valley called Sherpa Technology Group, and we advise technology companies on their business strategy. Prior to that, I was an investment banking analyst with UBS in New York during the financial crisis, advising many of the financial institutions that were having issues. And prior to that, I was at Princeton University, where I was a captain of the tennis team. So that's my background. And I have a book on consciousness that came out today. So I'm often asked, well, how did you even get there? And the very short story is that about 2 years ago, I became exposed to science that challenged my worldview, which we'll talk about, and really transformed how I thought about life. And as I told friends about some of the transformations I was having, and in particular, the science that I was looking at, it transformed their lives too, which led me to decide to put my thoughts on paper. And literally over a few weekends in July of 2017, I basically locked myself in my apartment in San Francisco and wrote the book. And that's the book that is out now. So on the topic of upside down thinking, I'm referring to what's known in scientific and philosophical communities as materialism. And that's a fancy word for saying that there was a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago that filled the universe with physical matter, things that we can touch. That's what I mean by matter, material.
Okay. All right.
Okay. And when you have enough matter in the universe, you're bound to end up through random chance to have interactions between those pieces of matter. That's called chemistry. With enough random chemical reactions, we're bound through chance to end up with a self-replicating molecule like DNA. So on Earth, DNA leads to the evolution of a biological organism like a human being, which develops a brain. And from the brain, out comes consciousness, our awareness, our subjective inner experience. So this chain I just described of materialism, we start with a material universe made of matter, and out on the other side comes consciousness through a brain. That is the materialist perspective that dominates scientific thinking and much of Western thought. And that thinking is what I'm calling upside down thinking.
Okay. And that explains certainly a lot of why we are where we are today in a manner of speaking. But then you started looking at this from a lot of different perspectives that certainly we actually delve into on this program time and time again. I'm working on this short little book called about choices. And the first step in this process of achieving what it is you want in terms of like our slogan is giving people choices and knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true. First thing is you got to make a choice. You got to choose something. What do you want? I put it to my present wife who was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer back in 2001. And I got to tell you, I fought over this question for a long time, but I thought, you know, I need to ask the question straight out. And I did. I said, do you want to live or do you want to die? Now, I may not like the choice you make, but I'll support you in it. But once you make that choice, then there are other things that come along. But what you're saying is that's really the process that we're talking about here, because you dive into a lot of the more esoteric, if you will, now I don't want to use that word. I was going to say occult, but not that word. Spiritual, metaphysical constructs that we have been reading about in, as I referred to earlier, the great ancient wisdom teachings throughout the world, down through the centuries. That it's thought, it's our I don't know if it's our minds, our consciousness that then generates and creates the material world, and not the other way around. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and so forth. To coin a phrase, if you will, is that where we're starting from here?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the materialist perspective is that matter creates consciousness through a brain, and I'm arguing that that is incorrect, and that instead consciousness is primary. So instead of starting with matter, we start with consciousness, and the physical world is an experience within consciousness, and consciousness exists beyond space and time. And under that construct, there are a number of phenomena, and most of the book And Ends Who Upside Down Thinking is devoted to looking at the scientific evidence for these phenomena, things like psychic abilities, things like survival of bodily death. All of those things are completely paranormal under the materialist perspective, where consciousness just comes out of the brain and is limited to the brain. But under this consciousness-centric picture of reality, those phenomena are actually predicted.
So if that is indeed true, then, I'm going to use the analogy that I've used over and over again on this program to help to understand this. We may not know exactly where consciousness resides, but we also do understand, at least I'm going to say I have an intellectual understanding, that it's all connected, that my consciousness and your consciousness are at some level connected, because you're doing your thing, right? You're writing your books, you're doing your research, you're interviewing these people, you're pondering these wonderful concepts. I love it. I absolutely love it. And I'm doing my thing over here, and I'm doing these interviews and working at the radio station, and I'm doing this and that and the other thing. But as we listen to, or I talk about the still small voice, that intuition, you know, and I need to find, we need to find out too, is that part of our consciousness? But anyway, we're doing our part. We're doing our individual tasks, similar to the character in Star Trek Next Generation, the Borg, which is made up of individuals, but they're getting information from a central location. But they're all working together, doing different things, but it's all part of a master plan, so to speak. Put it in that context for us as far as what you have discovered, or at least what you understand as far as, shall we say, the big picture?
Yeah, well, that's where I come out, what you just described.
Oh, okay.
I love the quotation by Erwin Schrodinger, the famous physicist, who said, "In truth, there is only one mind." And there's an analogy that I use in the book by Dr. Bernardo Kastrup, who wrote a book called Why Materialism is Baloney. So he and I share very similar perspectives. But the way he describes reality, and I love this analogy, is to describe all of reality as being like a stream of water, where water represents consciousness. And each of us is like a whirlpool within the broader stream of consciousness. So we're having a localized experience, but fundamentally we're all made of water, i.e. consciousness. So let's just say that some water from your whirlpool were to enter my whirlpool. That might be like a subtle telepathic ability, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Or imagine if my whirlpool or someone's whirlpool dissolves and stops being a localized whirlpool. That's like a person's physical body dying, but their consciousness doesn't die. It just transitions into a different state within the broader stream. The water doesn't leave the stream.
Hmm. Interesting, because this aspect of our existence has frustrated me to no end from this standpoint. The ancient, and again, I keep going back to them, the writings, because it's all I've got to work with in one sense. It tells us where we come from, the one. It tells us where we're going to, the one. And my frustration is, then why are we here in this dualistic world? It just doesn't make any sense to me, because I'm only 58, all right? And I know that my father, who is 87, is frustrated with the world as it is. He's still alive, kicking, doing well. I'm much younger than him. I haven't lived nearly as long, and I'm just as frustrated as he is about all of this conflict and this craziness and this stupidity and on and on and on. And it's like, I've had enough. I'm not checking out. Don't get me wrong, Mark. I'm not going to pull the trigger and check out of this world. But I'm tired of the drama, trauma, and so forth. It's like, this is ridiculous. Man has been doing this. It's almost as if when I was working for the Christian radio station and I kept hearing the message about Armageddon and the end of the world and 1,000 years of peace and all this kind of stuff. And even though I'd worked there for 10 years at that point, I said, I'm really bored with the story. Can we move this along? Is there something I can do to help move this story along so we can get to a new, as the term is these days, a new narrative? What about that aspect? I mean, you made reference to it, as a matter of fact, in that one quote, that there's one mind. I want to know if I've come to the wrong conclusion here, that liberty, freedom, and privacy are illusions. They don't really exist, especially when we're talking about the one mind.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm happy that you're not checking out, because you're doing very important work. So thanks for all that you do.
Thank you.
But to answer your question, it's a really important point. I think that we have these kind of localized experiences as whirlpools where we have the appearance of privacy. But if we're all part of the same stream of consciousness, arguably under that construct, everything is accessible. It's just a matter of whether we can access it and when and how. There's a phenomenon that I describe in Chapter 9 of An End to Upside Down Thinking called the near-death experience,
mm-hmm.
which I think is one of the most important phenomena that is understudied in the world right now. And there's incredible research out of the University of Virginia and elsewhere on this. But there's a phenomenon that happens in the near-death experience. So this is when a person has a highly impaired brain due to physiological trauma, typically, or in some cases they're in cardiac arrest and their brain is actually off. And yet they have this highly lucid experience that sometimes is verified as being accurate. So the person is hovering over his body and describes things in the room that are later shown to be true. So it's hard to reason that it's a hallucination, especially if the brain is actually off. But what people describe is a life review. And the life review is something in which the person experiences their whole life in a flash, and they're judging themselves for how they acted, and they're kind of replaying things that happened throughout their life. In many of those cases, what is described is that the person who has the life review takes on the perspective of those he or she affected. So let's say Bob has a life review in his near-death experience, and he recalls a time in which he did harm to Jane. He will experience that pain through Jane's eyes. So all of that information that seemed to be private at the time seems to be coming back, not only through his own eyes, but through the eyes of someone else. So it's as if there is this one consciousness, there's this one stream, and we can just simply switch the lenses somehow. And in our everyday experiences, we have just one lens. But in these altered states, we are able to experience things in a different way.
You know, you raise some very interesting points. I have always found these kinds of conversations so incredible. I have interviewed people who've had near-death experiences over and over again. I have never had one, at least not to my conscious awareness. I've not been in any traumatic or catastrophic kinds of accidents or incidents and what have you. I have had some surgeries, but you know, nothing of that nature. But the thing that has always struck me, first of all, whether it is a person who has had a quote-unquote religious experience or someone who has had one of these near-death or even out-of-body experiences, and then people come along and they challenge them, and they will say, oh, well, that's just, you know, the synapses of the brain, they're kind of firing in this, and that's why they're getting these experiences. And it's like, it doesn't make any sense. When you start interviewing the people who have had these near-death experiences who have nothing to do with one another, they're not connected in any way physically, materially, and yet they're having the same experience or virtually the same experience, and yet you're willing to dismiss that. And I've never, ever wanted to do that with anybody who's had these experiences because it's like saying, no, you don't have a left arm, and yet there it is hanging off of their left shoulder. No, you don't have a left arm. There is no left arm. You're a liar. You know, you're deceived. Or the thing that's even worse is there's nothing in the writings of our faith that says anything about this. And I even interviewed a fundamentalist Christian who practices out-of-body experiences, which are similar to near-death experience. And he induces them. And I said, I've read the Bible a few times, and I don't know anywhere in there that it says you should be doing this. But he doesn't have a problem with it, and he's not interested in checking out, but he certainly apparently loves the experience. I've also been introduced, and maybe you're, I don't know if you're familiar with this thing called Life Between Lives.
Yes.
You are familiar with it. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. I've actually had a session with a practitioner here in Santa Barbara. Fascinating. I mean, I have to tell you that if I could go back to the life that I had before this one, I would go back, and not that this one's bad, don't get me wrong, but it was fat. I was like, yeah, I liked that life. It was great. And I remember sitting down in front of the cabin that I was living in, remembering this experience, and just basically saying, this life was good. And I died. I just left. You know, it's like, then that's the way we all should be able to go. It's just relaxed and so forth. Have you ever had a near-death experience?
No, I have not. I'm often asked this question. I have not personally had one, but I've done so much research on the phenomenon that, like you say, it's very difficult to dismiss so many independent accounts and where people have similar reports. And this has also been described since the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, mm-hmm. Plato. It's only become more prominent recently because of resuscitation technology.
Yeah.
So we have more people coming back and therefore more reports of this near-death experience. But to me, what some of the most compelling cases are under cardiac arrest. So this is when a person is clinically dead, and we have people like Dr. Pim Van Lommel, a cardiologist, and Dr. Sam Parnia at Stony Brook, who are studying people in cardiac arrest. And there's a percentage of them who come back and describe this near-death experience. And in many cases, what's known as a veridical out-of-body experience is reported, meaning the person is out of his or her body during the near-death experience and reports something accurately that happened in the room during the time that their brain is off. And there's a paper, for example, in 2014 in Resuscitation Magazine by Dr. Sam Parnia, where there was one of his one of the patients who was in cardiac arrest had very detailed descriptions of things that happened when his brain was off. So to call that a hallucination that somehow is caused by a dying brain, I think that's an imaginative way of describing what happened. I think it's much more logical to explain that by saying that there is a consciousness that is existing when a functional body is off.
Mm. Yeah, and I have to wonder too, the person who's making that assessment, I'm wondering what's their agenda, or what is it that they're afraid of that would, if this were actually something that actually happened, that they're concerned, you know, it's like they're people who are afraid of death. Every time I hear about the passing of someone famous, I remember, for example, when Michael Jackson passed away, I was less concerned about how and or why. I wanted to know what he was experiencing. What was he going through? What was he doing? Well, I had that life between life experience, and I have a fairly good idea, assuming that what I experienced was certainly legitimate, and I've got no reason to believe otherwise, that's the process. There was a movie that was out, many years ago, with Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep, having to do with Life Review. And I thought it was fascinating because here's Albert and he's freaking out thinking, I'm going to be judged. And there's Meryl. She's just having a grand time, just doing all the things that she wanted to do when she was alive in a human body that she was doing there in spirit. And, so it's maybe there is some truth to that saying that, you know, whatever it is that we think heaven is what it will be for us when we get there, in a manner of speaking. What about the construct, if you will, if we want to use that word, what about the construct of God, the creator, the divine power, the force? What about that construct in all of that? Is that the same thing as the one mind, as I keep going back to that, and that maybe there isn't a single, shall we say, entity, but it's us, we are that?
That's where I think everything points. I tend to shy away from that word because it has so many different connotations and everyone has a different meaning for it, seemingly. Mm-hmm. But there's a quote from Rumi, the Sufi mystic, who said, I searched for God and I found myself, and I searched for myself and I found God. This notion of non-duality, that there is nothing outside of ourselves at the most fundamental level of consciousness, nothing outside of the stream. We're all part of the stream. So it really puts a different sense of accountability on each of us. And the Life Review reinforces that, where people come back from the Life Review forever changed. They don't care about material goods anymore. What they care about is how they treated people and how they treat people going forward, because that's how they judge themselves in the Life Review.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that when you started talking about materialism, and of course I've had a chance to, of course, look over the material, but still I think, yeah, and I look at this whole capitalistic way of living, and it's like there's just something wrong with this paradigm. It's first of all not sustainable. I think I was 10 or 11 years old, and I was learning about this whole aspect of, you know, you get a job, and, you know, and you start out at a particular level, dollars and cents wise. And, of course, back then, when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, your parents, they stayed at the same job for 20 or 30 or 40 years. And maybe they got a boost every year or two in their salary, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, if everybody did that, then that would presuppose that the company's got to come up with some way to afford to pay those increases. What do? They raise the cost of the product or service. All right, so now you don't have quite the buying power you used to, because now the product and service costs more. So you got to go back and ask for more money. And this is it, and it just keeps spiraling upward, if you will, or downward, as the case may be. And I'm thinking, this isn't sustainable. You can't keep doing this. And say, well, yeah, but you change jobs. Yeah, but you don't want to go to another job and make less than, and you certainly don't want a lateral move. You'd like to think that changing jobs, you're going to make more money. And then the cycle continues. And I have to wonder if maybe that's part of the problem that we've got today, is that everybody just wants more, more, more. And not just money, things. I mean, look at our society. Let me ask you to comment on this. I pondered this. First of all, I want to ask you, where do you come from philosophically? How were you raised on that spiritual and metaphysical level?
Well, I was very against anything spiritual personally, because I didn't see any evidence for it. And to me, I had a very rigorous academic background. And what I was taught was to question things and to believe things based on evidence. And what I was hearing in spiritual realms were things that had no evidence as far as I was concerned. So I was on the total opposite end of the spectrum until I became exposed to this whole new body of evidence. And we've only touched on very short snippets of it today so far.
Mm-hmm.
My book is the summary of all that evidence, where I got to the point where I couldn't reconcile that old very nihilistic and bleak worldview with these different pieces of data. And instead, when we look at this more consciousness-centric view of reality, all of these things make sense. Combine that with the fact that the question of consciousness, which I didn't even realize, is a huge question. We have no idea how a brain could produce consciousness. It's the number two question in all of science, according to Science Magazine. It's called the hard problem of consciousness in philosophy. And people like Francis Crick, who co-discovered the structure of DNA, after he did that, he spent the rest of his scientific career trying to figure out this question. How does a physical brain produce a non-physical consciousness? He couldn't figure it out. So when we step back and say, wait, we have no idea where consciousness comes from in the first place. All we know is that the brain is correlated with consciousness. Stimulate a part of the brain or damage it, you have a change in conscious experience. But there's an alternative possibility to explain that correlation. Correlation is not always causation. When two things are related, doesn't always mean that one causes the other. We could also look at the brain as like a filtering mechanism or like an antenna receiver. If you damage the antenna or the filter, you're going to have a different conscious experience. So when I put all these different pieces together of, wait, maybe we can recontextualize the brain. Wait, there's evidence for psychic phenomena from the U.S. government and Princeton and UVA. And, you know, you put it all together, my worldview shifted completely. And I want to go back to what you just described about implications for the world, because that's a hugely important point.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason that I felt so compelled to write this book in a short amount of time and get it out quickly rather than wait years is that we're in a downward spiral as a society. I mean, to turn on the news is a very depressing thing to see what's happening in the world. And to me, when I look at that with this new perspective, it all stems back to the belief that consciousness is a product of the brain, which has implications that we are all fundamentally separate and that we're finite beings. If that's not scientifically true, then to do harm to someone else is actually irrational. So I think many of the problems today can be corrected by an internalization of these principles, which I think are actually scientifically pointed towards.
Hmm. Well, I know that there are so many other issues that a lot of people are dealing with, not only in their day-to-day lives, but in terms of some of these subjects. I mean, you dive right into the paranormal. You dive right into phenomenon that a lot of people, they just don't want to have anything to do with. I mean, there's even simple stuff. I had an experience where I think it was an Easter Sunday, and we were having lunch or dinner at my parents' house, and I don't know how this thing got started, but I just happened to walk into the back bedroom, and there were my mother and sisters, and my mother was doing this scanning thing, and they asked me to lie down, and they would scan me. Well, my eldest sister, who is of a very rigid belief system, she did the scanning, and her hands got really hot when they were over my throat. Well, my career is with my voice and so forth, so it kind of stands to reason. And, of course, I know enough about the chakra systems and so forth. But she wasn't willing to accept the reality that this kind of connection, if you will, or awareness of another person's energy flow was possible, because it was contrary to what she understood of the writings that she followed. And I find that seems to be true with a lot of people, that if it doesn't fit with what you've been taught or what you've read. And that's why I am such a firm believer in people being really well read. I mean, get your hands on whatever you can and read it and incorporate that. It's one of the reasons why we do these programs and we lay out this smorgasbord. We want to give you all kinds of different choices. And if it doesn't resonate with you, leave it alone. But come back later next week, next month, next year, and try it. See what you think. Because I have been, as I've done these programs, Mark, I found it just fascinating where not only where you are coming from philosophically and scientifically as well, but you're doing something that a lot of people refuse to do, and that is take all of these different parts that are out there and you start putting them together and asking these questions. Is this part of the consciousness that we're talking about when we start to use logic? Because I'd like to think that, and actually I want to dive in a maybe a little different direction in terms of our intuition. Is intuition at all a part of this process as well? Is that part of our consciousness, or is that connected? I don't know. I'm trying to understand from the standpoint of the work that you have done from the book that you've written.
Mm-hmm. So I do think that intuition, what we call intuition, is very much related. So I'll refer to two different phenomena in some of the science that I think points to this very idea. So chapter 5 of An End to Upside Down Thinking is on the evidence for telepathy. There's a classic study known as the Ganzfeld procedure, where you have one person in a room, we'll call it Bob. Bob is in a room and he's listening to relaxing music. He's put in a relaxed state. Jane is in another room. She's shown a picture and she's told by the experimenters, Jane, please mentally send an image of this to Bob while he's in the other room. So she's doing that for a while. Bob comes out of his relaxed state and he's shown 4 pictures. The experimenters say, Bob, which of these 4 was Jane sending to you using her mind? Remember, Bob has not seen the picture that Jane was looking at. You would guess, if it were pure chance, that Bob would guess correctly 1 out of 4 times, 25%. What's found over decades of experimentation, when you combine the results across many different experimenters, is that it's not 25%. It's closer to 32%. And when you look at the statistics on this, the odds that that's just a chance occurrence is more than 1 billion to 1. So it's a very scientifically rigorous result where some information is getting through. Do we call that intuition, like a subtle knowing? Maybe. So that's one type of potential intuition. Mm-hmm. Another is chapter 6, which is on precognition. Ooh. Which is knowing the future before the future is ostensibly known. There are many studies that have been done where the body is measured before a picture is shown. And the way it's set up is that there's a computer that is randomly generating pictures. One type of picture is an arousing picture. It might be a violent scene. It might be something erotic. The other type of picture is a peaceful type of picture. So it might be like a mountain or a river, something that would not stimulate the body. In traditional psychological studies, people's bodies are measured after they see these types of pictures. And what's known is that the skin responds, the eyes respond, the brain, the heart, they will respond in a way that's consistent with the type of picture shown. So if it's an arousing picture, you'll see a spike in the skin response after the picture shown. If it's a peaceful one, you won't see that spike. What's done in these studies is that the body is measured before the picture is randomly generated. So no one knows what picture is going to come up because it's randomly generated by a computer. And what the experimenters find is that seconds before the picture is randomly generated, the body, meaning the skin, the eyes, the heart, the brain, all have been measured. All of those respond subtly before the picture is shown in a direction consistent with the ultimate picture. So it's like the body has a knowing. There's almost a reaching forward in time of consciousness that knows the future before it happens.
Well, now you're familiar with heart math?
Absolutely.
All right.
Some of the studies are heart math and Dr. McCrady.
Yeah.
Ran the heart studies.
Yeah, we've had those folks on the program as well. And you you raise a couple things. I had an experience of being in a class in my 20s by a woman by the name of Virginia Benderly, and what she did in the class with all of us. And this was primarily visually impaired and or blind people, but sighted people could participate. I was legally blind at the time. And what she would do is she would place photographs inside these manila envelopes, seal them, and then you would put your hands over the top of them. And you would describe the photograph. Now, I don't remember what my level of accuracy was, but that also, what you've also raised is another issue I want you to address. What's the connection between this aspect of precognition and déjà vu? Because my definition was that it's just my body. When I get to that place where I say, I've been here before, it's just my body is finally caught up in time with that slide or series of slides, if you will, of that particular moment in time where I say, I've been here before. And by the way, when I was 7, I had a day. I thought I was going to go nuts as a 7-year-old. I had a day like that. Every time I turned around, I've seen this before. I've been here before. And I had not. So what about déjà vu?
It's a really good question. And I think it's something that needs to be studied better. But looking at precognition and time is, I think, an important place to start.
Okay.
Precognition raises all kinds of questions about linear time. We're trained to think that time goes from past to present to future, and yet we're having the future affect the past in these studies. There's a future picture, and a few seconds before it's shown, the body's responding. So it's suggestive of some kind of what's known as retrocausality, where causation's not moving forward in time, but it's moving backward in time, which is totally counterintuitive. Where I come out on all this with time is that time is a linear time, past to present to future, is a mental construct that the human mind, which is inherently limited, it uses to organize the world around us. But in reality, consciousness is beyond space and time, and there's really just an ever-present now. So the deja vu might be a function of this lack of linear time, where for some reason consciousness is picking up something from what seems like the future, and we are have this knowing of the future because it's sort of already happened. That's the best hypothesis I can come up with right now, but I think it needs to be studied more. And part of the reason I think we don't have answers to these questions is that these topics are really shunned in many academic institutions. I mean, I have my own podcast coming out hopefully in a few months. I've interviewed many of these scientists, and they say that unless you get tenure, it's not worth spending time talking about precognition or telepathy because it's heresy, basically. So until this becomes mainstream where we say, okay, these are anomalies and sometimes they're just statistical where it's 32% versus 25%, until we start exploring and understanding how these things could be real, we'll still have big questions about phenomena that everyone experiences, whether it's deja vu or if it's something like, I think of someone and they text me and it can't be random. You know, we need to understand these better.
Mark Gober is my guest, and the book is An End to Upside Down Thinking. It's a new mindset through looking at life's challenging questions. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
What I tell you, I said we'd be right back, and we're right back here on Tell Me Your Story with Mark Gober, and his book is An End to Upside Down Thinking. The website, markgober.com. That's markgober.com. And Mark, thank you for staying with us here on the program. This is fascinating. Have you found in your study and research that the majority of, say, and I refer to them as philosophies, but you can use the word religion if you'd like. The world's philosophies, they address this. They spell this out, but sometimes it's been masked. It's been some of the context have been taken out of it and so on and so forth. But they do speak of this whole aspect, do they not?
They do. And I'm not a religious scholar, but as I've gotten into the science, it's naturally pushed me to look at what some of the ancient traditions have said. And what I found is that the mystical traditions within every religion, effectively, have said very similar things, where consciousness is primary, whether it's the Eastern religions or Gnosticism and Christianity, Kabbalah and Judaism, Sufism and Islam, they point to very similar principles. So I think it's very interesting that independent cultures have come to similar conclusions about reality.
What's the most astounding thing that you have found on this journey about yourself?
Well, this has been a reversal of thinking about my own identity. So the materialist perspective says that I am a body that has a consciousness. That's who we are. We are a body first and foremost, and consciousness comes out. This alternative perspective flips it and says that we are a consciousness first and foremost that's having a physical experience of a world through a body. So that's been it's been a very challenging thing to wrap my head around. And in the beginning, I didn't really know how to function in the world because so many people in my business world and the athletic world that I'm accustomed to, they're not familiar with these concepts. So I was like, well, how do I interact with people with this alternative perspective? I've been exposed to all this data that I know is not being taught. When I was at Princeton studying psychology, I didn't learn about any of this. How am I going to function having this different perspective? So that's been a challenging thing. But what I found is that there are many people who have had these realizations, whether through academics or through having their own personal experiences that they can't deny. And I think it's had a major impact on how I look at life and also on how I think about treating others and how I look at other people. I look at people as being far less separate from me than I used to. And I used to like to treat people well, but now thinking about this interconnectedness, it really places a new perspective on any individual. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter what the person is or how they're acting, whether they're rich or poor. It's part of the same stream of consciousness, just having a different experience. So I think it creates a different sense of empathy for other people.
Well, I can certainly see that. And I know that we all could use that different perspective, especially in this day and age. And it's really strange how that phrase, this day and age, is being used a lot in this day and age, because a lot of people are feeling a lot of different things. And I'm wondering where our emotions fall in this. Is consciousness and our emotion are let me get the grammar correct, folks. Are consciousness and emotion the same, and or are they connected?
I think there's certainly a relationship. The way I think about emotion in this framework is that it's something that we feel, and the feeling is happening in the physical. And as I said, I view the physical as an experience within consciousness. So everything that we see, smell, taste, those are all kind of modulations of consciousness, where consciousness is the witness and the emotions are being experienced by consciousness. So it's part of, to me, this is kind of the most logical conclusion I can come up with today based on the evidence I've seen, that emotions are certain experiences that consciousness is having that relate to our learning in this physical body.
So would you say that those things that are classified by some folks as miracles, whether you want to look at the miracles written about in the New Testament or otherwise, they're just our lack of understanding of how the universe works from that standpoint of our consciousness is able to manifest in the material, again, as opposed to the other way around?
I think those alleged miracles need to be looked at with a new lens. I mean, we could call people 200 years ago, imagine if they saw people speaking on cell phones from across the world. That would seem like a total miracle and magic, mm-hmm. where you can't see the waves. So a miracle is sort of a relative term. It's relative to a level of understanding at the time at which someone observes the miracle. Mm-hmm. So I think those phenomena need to be explored. Chapter 4 of An End to Upside Down Thinking is on a phenomenon known as remote viewing, which is the ability to perceive something with the mind alone at a distance. So you're not there physically, but you can see it and draw it out. That sounds like a total miracle. But the U.S. government ran a more than 20-year program on this. And in Chapter 4, I show documents that have been declassified by the CIA. And a direct quote from the documents, I show it in my book, "Remote viewing is a real phenomenon. Implications are revolutionary. Evidence too impressive to dismiss as mere coincidence." These are words from the CIA. So it seems like a miracle, but if you were working in that environment where the studies were run at Stanford and things are seen like this on a day-to-day basis, it becomes a bit more commonplace.
Yeah, well, I've even thought that Jesus, he didn't think it was a big deal when he was doing the things that he was doing, according to the writings. It's just that was what he did. It was normal for him. It's like a carpenter grabbing a hammer and being able to build a house. I couldn't do that. That'd be a miracle if I was able to do that. Or somebody coming in here and conducting the interviews that I'm doing, who has zero experience and is shy in front of public and so on and so forth. And yet we also have this, it's weird to refer to it as a phenomenon, because it's part of our existence as beings. But then again, how do we define who we really are? If we're residing in these vehicles, I talk to people about, for example, reincarnation. I use the example of, what was the first car you ever bought? Okay, and how many cars since then have you had? And what was the purpose of the car? For the most part, the purpose of the car, get from point A to point B. All right. So you've had 5 different cars in the last 40 years. All right, fine. And he didn't have a problem with that. Well, I don't know if reincarnation is definitely real or not, because I have read some other writings saying something else. But the reality is that, this vehicle is going to wear out one day. It's going to stop working. And yet we have people who live to 100, 110. They say that we lived even longer than that. Is the physical body and the material world really a relevant part of our existence as conscious beings, as spiritual beings, as metaphysical beings?
Well, it certainly feels that way when we're in the body. It provides a it's like an intense virtual reality that's ultra real. If we think of ourselves as kind of consciousness experiencing the world. So it provides experiences that I think afford different learning experiences. When we think about topics like reincarnation and survival of bodily death, I do have a chapter on the work at the University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies at the med school there, on children who have past life memories. Usually these are children between the ages of 2 and 5 years old who have very distinct memories that are sometimes verified by medical records. And it's very difficult to come up with reason with materialist explanations for how these things happened. And in some cases, to me, the most compelling cases are instances in which the children have birthmarks or physical deformities that match how they describe dying in the previous life. And these are not normal looking deformities. They're very specific. So it's suggesting this idea that you describe, that the body is kind of like a vehicle and that a certain vehicle wears out and then consciousness is inhabiting another one. And if we go back to the whirlpool analogy, it's like a whirlpool that dissolves, the body dies, and then becomes a different whirlpool. So I think it's totally conceivable under this consciousness-centric framework that there could be a kind of a redoing of experience through different bodies.
Okay, but when I go from one car to the other and I need to get from point A to point B, I go over and I open the passenger, I go over to the driver's side door, I open it up, I get in, close the door, put on the seatbelt, put the key in the ignition, turn the car on, and put my foot on the accelerator, and off I go. And so the equivalency thereof is they've got the body of the car, they've got the car, and the consciousness is me getting into the car. Now the car has consciousness. Where is there a specificity as to where the consciousness actually resides? Is it in the brain? Is it in the heart? Or is it just in the body and it's sort of nebulous in that sense? And this question really relevant as to where the consciousness, who cares as long as we have it?
I think it's a really important question because we need to understand this when we think about health, whether it's physical health or mental health. The way consciousness interacts with the body has a big impact, I think, and it's not well understood. You mentioned the heart and other parts of the body. There are cases of organ transplant donors. So these are people who have a transplanted organ, who take on memories of the person that they got the organ from, which is suggestive of something that's transferring from the physical from one to another that's not always the brain. It could be a heart or it could be a different organ. So it's suggesting that maybe the brain is not the whole picture in terms of consciousness or the transference of consciousness-related things. I think we need to be looking at this question of how does the body interact with consciousness, or the other way around, how is consciousness kind of inhabiting the body? What are the mechanics behind that scientifically? Because that will help us understand the body and therefore will help, I think, improve medicine.
Interesting. What part, in your perspective, from this research that you have done, which, first of all, I applaud you for going to the depths that you have in this. I have to say that some of my most incredible interviews, the most fun I have, is when I'm interviewing rabbis, knowing the education that they have to go through, and the conversations we have. And you're kind of up in that stratosphere with them, because this is fascinating stuff. Because you're absolutely right. There's a gentleman I was going to interview. I still may have a shot at it. He wrote a book called AD, After Disclosure. And this is after the governments of the world finally admit that, yes, we've been visited by aliens. We're not going to go there in this program. But I told him, I says, well, the very first question that I'm going to ask you is, what makes you think that the public is going to believe the governments who've been lying to them up to this point? And now they're going to say, oh, by the way, we're telling the truth now. It's like the crying wolf. When it comes to these kinds of things, you know, you've quoted from very what we'll consider reputable sources like the CIA and various government agencies and so forth, and institutions of higher learning who have done all these different pieces of research. Is there a way, from your perspective, is there a way internally that we can verify through our consciousness and or intuition that this information is accurate. And I'm not going down the road of fake news, okay? I'm not going down that road per se. But you and I both know that, especially during various conflicts down through the centuries, misinformation or disinformation or propaganda has been disseminated. And the case in point that I think of is the first Iraqi war, where Norman Schwarzkopf released to the media, these are our plans. This is what we're going to do. And he didn't do that. He did something totally different because he knew that the enemy was listening and was going to follow and so forth. So can't trust him because we don't know if he's telling the truth or not. Is there a way that we can verify this on some higher level that, these are questions need to be asked. This is information that is definitely accurate in terms of whether it's near-death experiences, whether it's a precognition, and the list goes on, that you talk about in your book. And maybe in a way I'm sort of playing the devil's advocate, but is there, as far as you know, is there a way that we can, is there a level of verification?
Well, first, I'd like to say that the way I structure the book is to show evidence for independent phenomena. So remote viewing, telepathy, precognition, psychokinesis, which is the way the mind affects physical matter, animals that have psychic abilities, near-death experiences, communications with the deceased, such as mediumship, and children with past life memories. What I reason is that if any of these phenomena are real, not all of them, if even one of them is real, then materialism cannot explain it, whereas a consciousness-centric framework can explain it. And I reason that if we look at the evidence from different areas, so it's not just the U.S. government, it's Princeton University, a lab run by the former dean of engineering, it's the University of Virginia, it's the Institute of Noetic Sciences, it's independent areas. Mm-hmm. To me, just like what I have to do in my business life is to evaluate business situations and look at the evidence. To me, it's unreasonable to conclude that all of these things are false or delusion or somehow fabricated. So that's one thing I would like to say, that I'm not necessarily saying that we can conclusively prove that all of these things are real. I think there's a high probability that many of them are, and that if any of them are, we have to rethink our paradigms. So that's how I'd start. But separately, how can we have an inner knowing that these things are real beyond looking at a scientific paper? Mm-hmm. The closest thing that I have seen is people who reach certain states of awareness, whether it's through psychedelics or near-death experience or a spontaneous kundalini awakening or through meditation or an enlightened state, where people somehow get what they'll call downloads of information on how the universe works. And in my assessment of talking to people who've had these experiences or just reading different things about it, it seems that they all converge on this general idea that I'm describing and that many traditions have described and which the science is pointing towards. So how can any of us individually achieve that? I think that's a challenge for all of us, is how can we kind of chatter the monkey mind that is going on in our head and kind of reach a state of pure consciousness, a state of accessing the broader stream. That's something that I don't think is harnessed very much in the society, and we're not maybe readily exploring how to do that beyond what some of the traditions have recommended.
An End to Upside Down Thinking is the title of the book. Mark Gober is my guest. MarkGober.com is the website. We encourage you to go there as well. This is very interesting stuff, Mark, because we only get to scratch the surface here because we only have a limited amount of time. And that's why I encourage people to go to your website and do further investigation. And I am fascinated by all of this because I'm trying to understand my part in the universe. Now, for the better part of my career, I've always felt that I've been in the right place at the right time. And I would have to say, for the most part, it's been fairly accurate. But there are a lot of people who they don't. They matter of fact, they have so much trouble fitting in, they don't fit in, and they check out. Which is really unfortunate, and I find that when we send people off to battle, I think, God, what a waste of potential! How much further along we could have been as a civilization if we'd had these people in here helping us out, you know, giving us their ideas, their concepts, their constructs, and so forth. That little piece that they could have contributed could have changed everything from where it is today. We'd have flying cars. We'd be living on the moon. We'd be traveling to and from Mars on a regular basis, you know, and those types of things. And yet at the same time, there's an aspect of all of this that you've certainly more than just alluded to, that it's that consciousness, it's that spiritual experience that is really paramount to our own existence, but not material existence. It's that metaphysical existence. Do you think that what you have opened up here in all these questions through the end to upside down thinking and getting people to think differently, to consider these questions, do you find that this is the natural part of our evolutionary process as conscious spiritual beings?
Well, any answer I give to that is speculative and inferential based on data points and individual anecdotes. But I would tend to say yes, that there seems to be what people all talk about who have mystical experiences and near-death experiences and mediums. They talk about the evolution of consciousness, where consciousness is kind of evolving collectively. And perhaps that's where we are as a society, where we're starting to open up to these ideas of the actual truth of reality. And we're seeing things like yoga and meditation, which maybe 20 years ago would have been totally out there in the mainstream culture, which are now part of mainstream culture. And those are practices that are getting us more in touch with our identity as consciousness, whether people realize that on a conscious level or not. So it seems like there's a shift in this direction. And I'm hoping that my book and exposure to these ideas in a hopefully something that appeals to the mainstream, and just the acknowledgement that there is this evidence base, whether you believe it or not, that recognition could help people to evolve their own consciousness, which evolves the collective consciousness.
Hmm. I'm curious if you practice meditation or yoga or any of these kinds of things in your day-to-day life.
I do. I probably could be better about it. But to me, it's both a practice of like a still practice of meditation, which I do sometimes, but also in daily life of kind of, wait a second, I'm getting caught into this ego body structure. Remember the true reality, which you've kind of proven to yourself scientifically, which is that I am a consciousness that's having this experience. And when you pull back like that, even during the day, multiple times, I think it really helps to take yourself out of situations that might be very stressful from the perspective of the limited ego or the limited body. When you pull back and take the broader perspective, it can help things throughout the day.
How much of this do you believe, and how much of it do you just know? You know that you know.
I think for me, it's really a combination, and it's still evolving because it's only been about 2 years, where it's a combination of having a sense that this is what's real and having talked to enough people who have had their own mystical experiences that I can't deny it. And then also the body of scientific and anecdotal evidence that I've seen, where I can't reconcile my old worldview. I can't come up with a picture of reality that is different from this consciousness-centric place. Mm. So it's kind of pushed me further and further in the direction of appreciating, probably at a level of knowing, that this is the nature of reality.
What about dreams? What's their part in all this?
Another really good question. I think we need to explore it. Dreams to me are a different state of consciousness, in the same way that the near-death experience is a different state of consciousness, or psychedelic experience is a different state. We do see sometimes, and I talk about this in chapter six on precognition, precognitive dreams, where people have a dream of something that ends up happening in vivid detail. So what is it about that state of dreaming that allows someone to access the future in some cases? What I liken it to is the remote viewers who I describe. These are people that go into a trance and are able to see things that are far away from them. People who are very highly psychic tend to go into a trance-like state or a dream-like state. So it's putting the mind into a certain state that makes perhaps the broader stream of consciousness more accessible. So maybe when we're dreaming, we're in that state where we're having experiences in other states of consciousness and perhaps able to access things we can't normally access.
Telepathy?
What about telepathy?
Is telepathy something that is on the horizon for us, or is it a reality today through some of this research that you talk about in your book, in terms of, because my best explanation or a description, not that I've experienced it, but my best description of telepathy is not words or sound, it's images, because if I can see the same exact thing that you're seeing, even though it's going to be filtered through my own personal experiences and so forth, my own ego aspect, I'm still seeing the same thing that you are seeing, rather than you trying to describe it to me with words, which really, you know, leave a lot to be desired when it comes to sharing information.
Well, people who are highly psychic, and the way I like to think about things is that I describe the Gonsfeld study, which is a type of telepathy where people are 32% accurate rather than 25%, indicating that there's some kind of mental influence that's being telepathically communicated. The people in those studies are everyday people who haven't trained psychic abilities. If you look at people in the U.S. government programs, they might be more skilled at something like that, and there's kind of a distribution of skill sets like there is in sports. You have all-stars and you have people that can – like you've got Michael Jordan, and then you have someone that can just dribble a basketball. So it's a spectrum that some people are better than others. When you look at some of the superstars in like mediumship, for example, people who can communicate with the deceased and who are very intuitive, they talk about different types of knowing. And one is visual, which you describe, but for some people it's auditory where they're actually hearing things. Mm. And is that telepathic? I don't know. Sometimes it's through smelling. Sometimes it's through just a knowing. And different people have different senses. So again, this is something that needs to be explored further because in the current paradigm, it's not something that's accepted generally.
So it sounds to me like what we need to do is step outside, as the analogy goes, not just the box, step outside the nine dots, in order to be able to really adequately investigate and research these particular, and I'll use the word phenomenon that we've been talking about in the program today.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons, again, that I felt so compelled to write this, is that we're at a state which I think is very similar to Galileo versus the church, where he had his evidence in the telescope and there were certain clergymen that didn't want to look in his telescope to see his evidence. We have a very similar dynamic right now where I would say mainstream academia, mainstream thinking is sweeping these ideas under the rug because it's just, you know, 32% versus 25%. And it just seems like it's impossible. Until we appreciate the potential reality of these things, we're not going to be exploring them fully. And I can only imagine the types of advances we'll see scientifically, technologically, medically, and then also on the scale of interpersonal relationships. Mm. This has the potential to really shift the planet.
You know, it's interesting, too, because there's only one occupation, one job where you can be considered successful. And you're only at 33% efficiency. And that's baseball. There is no other job on the planet, no other endeavor that allows you to only be 33% successful. And yet here you are talking about this, which it's up from 25, now up to 32%, which again is quite phenomenal. The future as you see it, what do you see for the future of man, and maybe a better way to put that is, what do you see as our evolution? Where do you think we'll be in 100 or 1,000 years, or will we even exist? Because we've done it again. We've annihilated ourselves, and we're going to have to be reseeded and start over from scratch.
Well, I think we're at a very important inflection point, where to me it comes down to this idea of materialism. And if materialism prevails as the overarching framework for how people live, I don't see how it's sustainable, especially with the rate of advancement of technologies that we can use to destroy ourselves. With the materialist, individualist perspective, it's very problematic. And Rupert Spira, who is one of my favorite philosophers from the non-dual perspective, I quote him in my book towards the end of it, and he says something along the lines of, if we look back in 500 years and the human species hasn't survived, it will likely be because the materialist perspective prevailed. Mm. So this is the time, I think, to where we have enough science that's actually pointing towards a different view of reality that I think could take us away from the downward spiral that we're on.
Well, I'm hoping that I'm in the same room and in the same category as you. When I was working at the Christian station, I was asking all kinds of questions that I think would have been deemed heresy, and of course I would certainly let them emblazon that on my forehead and wear it proudly, because the answers I was given just didn't make any sense to me. you know, that you die once and then there's the judgment. Well, wait a minute. What about Lazarus? You know, and these kinds of things. And then in our modern day, you've kind of sort of talked a little bit about this, but in our modern day, I'm sitting here and I'm asking these questions. Right prior to 2 years ago, right prior to our general election, the statement was made by one of the candidates that the system is rigged. The election is rigged. All right. So that means that if you lose, you're going to be screaming bloody hell until the cows come home. And if you win, the system is still rigged, which means that you cheated. And if there's fake information that's being disseminated, then that's always fake. It's not fake sometimes. It's not fake when you want it to be and then when you don't want it to be. And these are the kinds of observations that I come to, and I'm not sure if that qualifies for this ending of the upside down thinking and trying to think in the right side up pathway and saying, look, you can't have your cake and eat it too, or you can't have it both ways. It's one way or the other. Pick.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're describing, whether or not you know these sorts of things are happening, is they're at the core caused by the belief in like hardcore individuality, that we're all separate. Mm-hmm. If we believe that we are fundamentally interconnected, that you are me at the most fundamental level of the stream of water, then it's irrational to do harm to another. It's actually selfish to be altruistic because mm-hmm. you're helping yourself. So to internalize that idea, I think gets rid of all these problems, because people wouldn't be trying to harm each other. They wouldn't be trying to one-up another person. It would be much more collaborative. And I know it sounds utopian, but that's actually what the science is pointing towards in terms of our reality, an interconnected, quantumly entangled reality where we're not as separate as we think.
Well, Greg Braden talked to us about that on this program several years ago, and he said that there have been study after study after study after study that shows that the greatest productivity amongst two groups, Group A and Group B, the most productivity was not amongst the group that was competitive. It was amongst the group that was cooperative. And that's kind of what you're describing, isn't it?
I am. And it is not how I was really raised culturally. That's not what's fostered in our system today, which is a very competitive one. And competition does drive innovation, but I think there can also be a lot of innovation and progress through collaboration and cooperation if we're all using our unique attributes to help one another. And that's not really what the prevailing thinking is today.
Well, James Redfield, I think, put it the best in his book, Celestine Prophecy, which I did not know had been made into a movie until the other night when my wife found it on, Amazon Prime or Netflix? And we actually watched it. It was 2006 when it was released. But he talks about how we have messages for one another. And when we go into a relationship with the shields up, as I like to put it, those messages can't get out. And so we're denying ourselves and the other person the messages that we have for one another. And so we can't move forward. We can't continue building on and adding to the puzzle that we're trying to put together that will help us to understand ourselves and our world.
I totally agree with that. I totally agree. And on a personal level, the way I'm expressing that, at least right now, is through a book to provide that knowledge to people that I've spent a lot of time pulling together in the hopes that will open certain people up to these ideas and might help their lives in ways that they need it. And for each of us, it might be a different way of communicating things. For me, it's writing a book and maybe speaking about it. For other people, it might just be something totally different.
An End to Upside Down Thinking is the title of the book, and it is Mark Gober who is my guest. MarkGober.com is the website. And Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. As I do in every program, I want to invite you, should you find yourself out here in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I think we could go on for another hour.
I think we could. And, I'm in the Bay Area, so I'd be happy to do it.
That'd be fantastic. Before we let you go, three final questions that I ask all my guests. And again, we thank you for giving us so much time here on the program. And we encourage our listeners to go to richarddugan.com radio shows page, SoundCloud, iTunes, listen to the entire interview. If you think that we ended at 50 minutes with the radio broadcast, think again. Think differently. First question is, who is Mark Gober?
Mm. Well, if we want to get really metaphysical about it, Mark Gover is a physical body and a collection of thoughts that is being experienced by consciousness. So I am an experience within consciousness and one of many different experiences that is being had.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I think there's a range of possibilities. And it starts with how I described my path earlier, where when I was telling people about these concepts and the science and framing the questions, it was having a very positive impact on certain people's lives, and their lives have shifted, and I've watched it happen as we've remained friends. So what I'm hoping to do with the work that I'm bringing to the world is to enable that on a much bigger scale so that people can read my book and listen to interviews and have shifts in their lives that are very positive, especially people that might be going through difficult times. I think these ideas are very comforting, and they also seem to be real. On a bigger scale, if we can get behind these ideas conceptually as a broader society, where instead of materialisms being the paradigm, if we shifted to something else that is more scientifically accurate and also one that encourages more collaborative thinking and acting, then I think the world can shift. So I would love to see both individual and global transformations.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Well, I think following my passions, and for people following their true passions, tends to work. That's just what I found anecdotally. And for me, my passions are to bring this kind of information to the world. Whether that's my purpose or not, it's hard for me to verify one way or another. But I think following my passions and trying to be of service to other people and trying to help people is certainly what I'm passionate about.
It's a new mindset through looking at life's challenging questions with an end to upside down thinking, dispelling the myth that the brain produces consciousness and the implications for everyday life. Mark Gober, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. Greatly appreciate it. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.